Welcome to a new year of Unusual Sources programming. We decided to try a little experiment and conduct an interview via Skype while the program was in holiday. And Stephen Gowans is a very good sport, and he agreed to be our very first ever Skype interview. And he was great, although there were some technical hiccups on my end. The sound is a bit tinny and the connection was a little choppy, but Gowans came through loud and clear. So I'm really pleased to say that our interview, Bridging 2016-2017, is now available, and coming up is an in-depth conversation with Stephen about the nature of the Syrian war and resistance to imperialism. And you're listening to Unusual Sources, our special holiday podcast edition, closing out 2016, I suppose, bringing in the new year. And it's very appropriate we have one of our favorite guests on the program today, and that's Ottawa-based author, journalist, and commentator Stephen Gowans. And I think he's on Skype with us now. Stephen, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you, Brendan?
Pretty good. It's a new technology for us, as you know, but I think we're really excited, and our listeners are excited that we can potentially get more interviews and with people that are even hard to reach by phone. But thanks for being with us during the holiday season, Stephen. You have a lot of fans, and you've been giving a lot of commentary on very important events with regard to Syria, Middle East, and so on. And I guess I'm going to talk about some of the articles you wrote in the last section of 2016, the last part of the year, the revolutionary distemper that wasn't, the regime that isn't. It's really great, actually. People had been wondering where you were, looking forward to your articles for a while, and there had been a gap of a few months, and I guess people were starved. And then you had that great article, the revolutionary distemper that wasn't, back in October, talking about what actually happened in 2011 in Syria and Washington's designs on that region. And then more recently, the regime that isn't. Now, there's a shibboleth for you. You've talked about shibboleths in the past, words that kind of convey characteristics of the person speaking. The regime. Regime is a word that is very loaded. And I guess that's what I wanted to get into, because there's a double standard in terms of how the United States refers to foreign governments. It seems that if you refuse to follow Washington's economic prescriptions, then you are a regime. But if you accept Washington's economic prescriptions, its political prescriptions, then you're not a regime. And you provided in that new article an example of that dichotomy in terms of how Washington treats Saudi Arabia as compared to Venezuela. You know, the New York Times is always celebrating the king of Saudi Arabia, while calling Venezuelan president strongman and dictator. And the way that they distort reality has become kind of a farce at this point. But there's that whole article with the Christmas toys in Venezuela, and it kind of revealed a lot. What did you think we learned from that article about Venezuela's government stealing Christmas?
Yeah, I was kind of struck on, it was December 18th, so not too long ago. I was reading the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and I read about U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry visiting Riyadh, where he was rhapsodizing about His Majesty King Salman, who is the head of an absolutist state. And he was talking about how it was that Saudi Arabia was a very good and an important friend and ally of the United States. Emphasizing the United States has a partnership with Saudi Arabia that's very valuable, and that the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia is very strong in all dimensions. And he also went on to add that that relationship has been a priority for the U.S. administration and for many other administrations. But it struck me that the U.S. government's friend and partner is a tyranny. It's a tyranny which crushed the 2011 Arab Spring uprising for democracy that happened in that country or kingdom, and it did so with tanks. It also sent tanks into Bahrain to crush a related uprising, and these uprisings are uprisings for a transition from absolutist monarchy to democracy. So the Saudi authorities had suppressed this movement for democratic rule, not only through tanks, but through executing the uprising's leadership. And they relied on decapitation as their favorite method of eliminating democratic troublemakers. And then, you know, Saudi Arabia has all kinds of, you know, repellent characteristics. It's official misogyny, for example. Saudi clerics propagate around the world this kind of austere, hate-filled, anti-Shia strain of Islam. And yet, it's the friend and partner of the United States. So the same day, December 18th, the Wall Street Journal carried a story about the dictator who stole Christmas. And I wondered who this dictator who stole Christmas was. And the dictator who stole Christmas, according to the editor of the Wall Street Journal, who is Mary Anastasia O'Grady, who wrote the article, was Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela. So the president of Venezuela didn't come to power as King Salman did through, you know, this hereditary succession. He was actually elected in elections that no one would ever dismiss as not being free and fair. So it's really kind of astonishing that we could have, I should add, that in addition to calling Maduro a dictator, the Wall Street Journal referred to Venezuela as a regime and a dictatorship. It struck me that these words, dictator, regime, strongman, you'd also refer to Maduro as a strongman, these could be aptly applied to King Salman or to any of the, you know, kind of royal potentates who are the great friends and partners of the United States in the Persian Gulf. And yet, I don't recall, or if this has happened, I've never seen it. I've never seen either Western officials or Western media refer to, we'll take Saudi Arabia, for example, the Saudi king as a dictator. Although he's a dictator in a sense, a royal dictator. I've never seen them refer to Saudi Arabia as a regime. I've never seen them refer to King Salman as a strongman. Although all of those labels fit. So there's quite this double standard in which, if you think about it, what's the source of the double standard? The source of the double standard is that those countries which accept U.S. leadership, U.S. global leadership, because Washington likes to regard itself as the indispensable country in the world. Washington has said that it can and will lead the international order, then it can and will lead the global economy. In countries which accept the U.S. role as the global hegemon are treated deferentially by the press and by Western officials. In countries which don't accept the U.S. self-proclaimed leadership role are treated very harshly. And it brings to mind a comment that was once made by a U.S. official that appeared in the Washington Post, which essentially said, those countries which cooperate with us, we give a free pass. Those which don't, we ream as best we can. And those who don't are those who reject U.S. leadership, U.S. global leadership, or if you want to put it in another way, the international dictatorship of the United States.
Yes, I mean, there's so many examples of that treatment where they are hands-off on one government and ream the other one. Venezuela and Saudi Arabia, you know, two countries reliant on oil exports, I mean, they provide such a great contrast in the story you mentioned from the holiday Who Stole Christmas story to the fact that, look how the United States treats Saudi kings when they die. They go and they meet the government and say, we're so sad, and he was our best friend, and so on, and it's an emerging democracy. When Chavez died, they were basically celebrating, and they had only nasty things to say, and they said, well, maybe there's good possibilities now for Venezuela. That's how the Canadian and U.S. governments dealt with that. There's so many examples of that, and as you say, it's based on your adherence to the U.S.-led international order. And obviously for us right now, Syria is a focus. And you've written quite extensively on the issue that Syria has been targeted for a regime change for quite a number of years now by the United States because it is not playing ball with this international order. Now, this is interesting because there's a number of debates circulating right now as to whether this is the case. And the Syrian government, I mean, you point out in the US's own documents, it sees the Syrian government as socialistic. It has these programs that are deemed unacceptable to Washington, that it resists US ordering of the Middle East in terms of support for Israel and things like that. Why do you believe this, or why do you argue this? In terms of Syria having its own policy that is not aligned with the United States, what are its domestic and foreign policy elements that cause you to write about that?
Well, I think I've been arguing this, but I've noticed recently someone said that this argument had come from Noam Chomsky as well, that if you really want to understand U.S. foreign policy, you need to understand the people who formulate it, where they come from, and what interests or what objectives they're trying to establish. Now, you can read U.S. foreign policy documents, because they're widely available. I mean, they're publicly available. Take, for example, the U.S. or the 2015 U.S. National Security Strategy document, which is a really interesting document to read. Because it's about national security, you would expect it to be about the military, for example. But a lot of it is about economics. And a lot of it is about how the United States positions itself in the world as the leader of a global international order. So it says essentially the world expects us to lead, and that's the role that we've taken on, and we expect everyone else to fall into line. And the reason why is because we want to establish an economic order that comports with the interests of corporate America and Wall Street, so of American businesses and American investors and American corporations. Now you look at Syria, and you look at everything about the Syrian. Well, let me back up. Syria right now, or for many, many years, has been governed by secular Arab nationalists who are attached to the Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party. This is a party that has a goal or a mission, and the mission is summed up in a slogan. Their slogan is freedom, liberty, and socialism. And what that means, or rather, unity, liberty, and socialism, what that means is their goals are to establish unity of the Arab world, to establish independence from foreign domination, and lastly, to achieve socialism. Their socialism is defined as public ownership of the economy and state planning as a means of overcoming the legacies of colonialism. So essentially, their goals are to reject foreign domination. Well, that immediately stands athwart the goals of the United States, because the United States is saying we are the world leaders and everyone else will fall in step behind us. And so the Arab nationalists, the secular Arab nationalists, are saying, no, I mean, we're going to pursue our own course. We're not going to be subordinate to the United States. We've already been subordinate to Europe because the Arab nation was never achieved independence or self-determination. It was carved up after the First World War by France and Britain. But we're going to achieve our own self-determination. We're also going to overcome our economic underdevelopment through various economic measures, which would be subsidies for Arab industry. We're going to incubate industry behind tariff walls. We're going to have state ownership of certain, significant parts of the economy. All of these things, all of this orientation is diametrically opposed to the orientation of U.S. foreign policy. U.S. foreign policy is quite explicit. It says what we're trying to establish throughout the world is a level playing field for U.S. businesses, which means no tariffs, no incubating local industry. we're looking for a free enterprise. We're not looking for states that are going to establish state-owned enterprises. And we're not looking for states that are planning their economies. That's completely inimical to our national interest of the United States being the interests of American corporations and investors and banks. So there's this hostile relationship between Syria on the one hand and the United States on the other, because they're trying to achieve mutually hostile goals, mutually exclusive goals.
Irreconcilable goals to some extent, I suppose. Syria has demonstrated independence or some degree of independence from this international order. And it just strikes me, I was looking at your October article, The Revolutionary Distemper That Wasn't, and in it you explain the outset of the insurrection in Syria in 2011, the latest Islamist insurrection. And in that article you talked about how the Western papers interviewed people in Syria because it was the time of the Arab Spring uprisings, and they were looking for an Arab Spring uprising in Syria. And what they heard from students and others, well, they talked to students, and the students said, well, you know, we don't really want to rebel. I mean, they give us free books, they give us free tuition, you know, post-secondary, you know, they've got a system where we can get educated and get jobs. So why would we rebel? You know, this isn't one of these more neoliberal countries that had these uprisings. And so they talked to other people, and they did opinion surveys and opinion polls, and people said, oh, no, we're not going to have this uprising. And there was evidence from talking to people in Syria, evidence from the complaining that's going on within internal U.S. documents, that there are these public institutions in Syria. Essentially, the country is spending a portion of its revenue on its own people, and this isn't being directed by U.S. Finance capital, and it's not part of their circuits, and it's basically substituting for foreign businesses. And so I guess these are some of the elements in economic policy that's frustrating them. And in terms of Israel-Palestine, I know the Syrian government's been criticized for not doing enough to retake the Golan Heights or to go after what Israel's borders are, but they have been a steadfast ally of the Palestinian cause for decades now, and they haven't wavered on that, and they haven't wavered on their opinions about the legitimacy of the occupation, which is something that I don't think other Arab governments really do.
No, and I mean, that's part of the goal they have of establishing Arab unity, which means that they are pro-Palestinian, and they have been ardent supporters of the Palestinian cause for decades. And this has also got them into trouble with Washington. So in 2003, the U.S. government demanded that the Syrian government cease support for the pro-Palestinian liberation groups. And it was providing substantial support, including offices in Damascus for Hamas, for example. The United States demanded that the Syrian government cease its funding and assistance to these Palestinian liberation groups. It refused to do so. And this became one of the reasons why the United States has sought to overthrow this secular Arab nationalist government in Syria. Again, because it's a secular Arab nationalist government, it's an ideological government, it's committed to Arab unity. An important aspect of Arab unity is establishing Palestinian self-determination as part of Arab self-determination.
Yes. So basically, if you want to enact your own agenda as an independent country in the Middle East, you want to spend money on yourself, you want to have some form of welfare state or social redistribution, you want to support your neighbors, your allies, you want to support the Palestinian cause, you want to support other people who want to be independent, that implies a certain political and economic strategy on the part of these countries, some form of socialism, some form of anti-colonial resistance, and there's different ways that can take shape, but obviously this is inimical to Washington's designs on the region. We've had this 5-year war in Syria, and this really is a situation where you have the United States and its military allies, Turkey, its puppets like Saudi Arabia, funneling in all sorts of fighters and weapons to keep this conflict going, making it possible to have this bloody war. And, you know, when people talk about the horrors and the suffering in Syria, they often apologize for and excuse basically this whole insurrection, which is dominated by some of the most reactionary forces in the world. And you address this in many of your recent writings. It seems that, you know, for people who are calling themselves leftists, there's this sort of comfortable, evidence-free assertion that the armed opposition in Syria began as a sort of resistance to neoliberalism. If you want to seem like a nice person, you say, well, you know, I mean, there are these people and they wanted better life and they demonstrated against neoliberal cuts and reforms in Syria. I guess they were holding up signs saying down with neoliberalism, and then Assad dropped barrel bombs on them. And then so naturally the Muslim Brotherhood and ISIS took over part of the country because that just makes sense. So I'm wondering, you know, what can you tell us about the driving forces behind the initial insurrection and what relationship they have to political economy, or what do they want for Syria? What's their vision for Syria?
So let me address this idea about the uprising being an uprising, is kind of like this secular democratic uprising against neoliberalism, or maybe not a secular democratic uprising against neoliberalism, but it's some uprising against neoliberalism. And let me tell you why I think that that view is insupportable. The first is because there's no evidence that the Syrian government is neoliberal. In fact, everything would suggest quite the opposite. And what's important is, how does the United States regard the Syrian government? It regards it not as a neoliberal state, but as a socialist state. And to provide evidence of that, let's just think about the constitutions of Syria. When you go back to the 1973 constitution, and that constitution, it was said explicitly that the Syrian Arab Republic would be socialist. Those are the words they use, socialist. They would have a planned socialist economy. These aren't my words, it's their words. We'd have a planned socialist economy to end all forms of exploitation. Natural resources and public utilities would be publicly owned. Taxes would be progressive. Social security is guaranteed. All education is to be free, and the state would guarantee health services. Now, in Washington, this is 1973, when that constitution was established by Hafiz al-Assad, who is the father of the current president, Bashar al-Assad. Hafiz al-Assad was regarded in Washington as an Arab communist. Washington talked about Syria as socialist Syria. Okay, so you could say maybe that was decades ago. What's happened today? Well, the U.S. State Department, and you can find these documents because they're all publicly available, the U.S. State Department has complained that Syria has failed to join an increasingly interconnected global economy, that ideological reasons have prevented Bashar al-Assad from liberalizing Syria's economy, that privatization of government enterprises is still not widespread. And they complain that the economy remains highly controlled by the government. Another interesting document from the U.S. government is the United States Congressional Research Service wrote a document in 2005 about Syria. In that document, they describe Syria's economy as largely state-controlled, dominated by the public sector, which employs 73% of the labor force, and is based largely on Soviet models. Well, any economy that's based largely on Soviet models can hardly be described as neoliberal. If we look at the 2012 Constitution, so the Constitution of 1973 was amended in 2012, largely in response to the uprising. If you look at that constitution, what you'll see is there is provision for security against sickness, disability, and old age. Now remember, these are things enshrined in the constitution. Access to health care, free education at all levels. At minimum, half the members of the People Assembly, so the legislature, have to be drawn from the ranks of peasants and workers. Natural resources, facilities, institutions, public utilities, according to the Constitution, must be publicly owned. And the national economy, this is quote, the national economy shall be based on the principle of developing public and private economic activity through economic planning. So, I mean, any country that enshrines within its constitution the principles of public ownership of the commanding heights of the economy and economic planning can hardly be called neoliberal. And it's quite clear that the United States doesn't regard the Syrian economy as neoliberal or the Syrian government as neoliberally oriented. The second thing about the uprising, so if we're going to argue that the uprising was really a resistance to neoliberalism, some kind of secular democratic uprising, then you'd be ignoring history. I mean, you can't look at Syrian history as starting in 2011. You have to look at Syrian history over the last few decades. Islamist insurgencies have been a regular occurrence in Syria since 1963, or since the early 60s, when the secular Arab nationalists came to power. Now, the secular Arab nationalists and Islamists have been the main contending forces for control of the Syrian state since the end of the Second World War. And what people don't recognize is the significant influence that Islamists have had in Syria for decades and decades. Now, they don't also recognize the extent to which the United States has been interested in ousting the secular Arab nationalists from Syria for quite some time, too. I mean, we can go right back to 2001, when Wesley Clark was the U.S. Army general. Had said on Democracy Now! That he'd been told at the Pentagon that the Pentagon planned to take out Syria within the next 5 years, along with a number of other countries. Turned out they didn't, and the reason that the United States didn't take out Syria became clear in a 2005 congressional research report, which said that the United States intended to invade Syria, but decided that it couldn't because its hands were full with the invasion and occupation of Iraq. In 2002, Washington added Syria to its axis of evil list. This is essentially, virtually, a declaration of war.
Hit list.
Yes. Then in 2003, after they decided, well, we can't invade Syria because our hands are full with Iraq, they imposed sanctions. Very little is ever said about these sanctions, but the sanctions have been in effect since 2003. In October of 2011, the New York Times reported that the Syrian economy was buckling under the pressure of sanctions by the West. By the spring of 2012, these kind of sanctions-induced financial hemorrhaging had forced, according to the New York Times, had forced the Syrian officials to stop providing education, healthcare, and other essential services in some parts of the country. By 2016, U.S. and EU economic sanctions on Syria were causing huge suffering among ordinary Syrians and preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid, according to a leaked internal report, which led Patrick Coburn, you know, the kind of veteran foreign correspondent, to liken the sanctions on Syria to the sanctions that have been imposed on Iraq. So you have this effort to kind of generate misery in Syria as a way of subverting or undermining the government. In 2006, there's a group established called the National Salvation Front, which includes the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood being the main Islamist group which has launched riots, uprisings, insurgencies against the Syrian secular nationalists since the mid-60s. So this front has at least two meetings in the White House in 2006, according to the Washington Post. And the Washington Post also says, beginning in 2006, that the White House starts to secretly finance Syrian political opposition groups, including the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. In 2007, this Syrian Muslim Brotherhood front organization starts meeting with the U.S. State Department and the U.S. National Security Council, and also with a group called the Middle East Partnership Initiative, which does kind of what the CIA once did covertly, which is to funnel money and expertise to fifth columnists in countries whose governments Washington opposed. Then in 2009, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood denounced the Syrian government as this foreign and hostile element in Syrian society, which needed to be eliminated. And in late 2010, just 3 months before this March 2011 riot that kind of marks the beginning of the uprising in Syria, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood voiced their hope for a civil revolt in Syria. And they say, wherein the Syrian people will perform its duty and liberate Syria from a tyrannical and corrupt regime. We know later, by 2012, when the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, or a document of that agency, is leaked, which says that the Muslim Brotherhood and al-Qaeda in Iraq, supported by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, and Western powers, rather, are the principal forces in this insurgency or uprising. So, I mean, if you look at Syrian history, what you're looking at is a very strong Islamist movement, Sunni Islamist movement, that wants to overcome the secular Arab nationalist movement that's in government and wants to establish a state in which all jurisprudence is based on essentially on the Sunni Islamist interpretation of the Quran. In none of this, and I mean, it's those who argue that there's some kind of neoliberal uprising against neoliberalism, I've noticed, never cite any kind of evidence.
Yeah.
These are usually arguments that are made by assertion. I've never seen any evidence.
Yeah, I mean, the revolutionary distemper that wasn't. It's the revolution that wasn't. I mean, it's starting to bring into question here what a revolution is. Because if you have a government that's committed to some elements of historically progressive thought and governance, removing a European colonial influence in a region, supporting the Palestinian struggle for liberation, engaging in economic nationalism. These are things to elevate the status of the countries in the Middle East and Arab people that adopt this. Now, you know, if you have a bunch of people that are in league with NATO and the United States and France and the former colonial occupiers and Israel and, you know, Turkey and all of this to remove that, I mean, you're not really dealing with a revolution. And when you're looking at these two forces, you know, what they call the Syrian revolution is a counter-revolution. I mean, that would be the language you would historically use for that. And I think with regard to the elements that are involved in this, as we're seeing in Aleppo, we're getting accounts now of what it was like to be governed by these rebels. We've already have ISIS or ISIL in one part of Syria. You have all of these other al-Nusra-affiliated groups. I mean, they're not taking Syria forwards. They're taking Syria backwards.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, the way I look at this is, I think there are three forces that have been struggling for control of the Syrian state since the end of the Second World War. And those forces are secular Arab nationalism, which is a reaction against European colonialism. There is political Islam, which is also a reaction against European colonialism, but has different goals than secular Arab nationalism. And there's U.S. imperialism. And U.S. imperialism has allied itself with political Islam to try to displace the secular Arab nationalists. But the United States has made it quite clear that it has no intention of allowing political Islam to take control of Syria. They're willing to use political Islam and, you know, these al-Qaeda-derived groups, or al-Qaeda, essentially, in Syria to destabilize the government. I mean, you can read, again, if you read Congressional Research Service's documents on this, you'll see that the U.S. plan is quite clear, and they've been quite open about it, if you want to look at it. They've been quite open about how it is that essentially they're trying to pressure Assad and his secular Arab nationalist colleagues to step down and allow a political transition, not to political Islamists, but to people who are going to govern Syria on behalf of the United States, who are going to accept the United States leadership role in the world, and who are going to accept that the heavy hand of government doesn't need to be on in the economy, as Obama says. So, I mean, the likelihood that political Islamists coming to power in Damascus, I think, has always been, well, it's never been particularly great, mainly because the United States will be vehemently opposed to that, just as much as they're vehemently opposed to secular Arab nationalists remaining in government in Damascus.
Right. They want freedom fighters for democracy, which, you know, but they establish a U.S.-friendly neoliberal government. That's what they essentially want. And the Syrian government was not nearly sufficiently neoliberal or a comprador state enough for them. And, you know, ultimately, I think there needs to be a more materialist approach when people discuss this. You have people on the left who are condemning Syria for not being left-wing enough, for being too neoliberal. Well, what are the other countries in the region like? You know, how democratic are they? What are their elections? How does their government get formed? What is their spending policies like? What's their relationship with Israel? Syria is one of the more progressive states in that region, and it's a very difficult region. It's a tough neighborhood, and we have been living under 30 or 40 years of, you know, this sort of liberal virus in terms of the spread of a global economy of neoliberal globalization. We had the collapse of the Soviet Union. So that country's gone. All its allies like Cuba and Syria, Vietnam were cut loose. It was not a situation in which people were going to turn into more left-wing welfare spending, you know, colonialism fighting governments. They're just trying to hang on. And that's the world we live in. And Syria is trying to hang on, and the United States is trying to knock it off the cliff using reactionary proxies so it can put in a much more neoliberal government, a much more compliant government, and a much more servile government like the ones they have in the region that are Syria's neighbors. So, you know, when you look at Syria, you have to look at it in the context of a multi-decade counter-revolutionary period, a era of reaction. And Syria's been holding out when you compare it to most of the other countries. It's been trying to preserve some of the elements that were part of that anti-colonial revolutionary period of the mid-20th century.
Right. Now, I mean, you've said that the United States wants to impose a more servile and a more neoliberal government, which would suggest that the Syrian government is perceived by some to be somewhat servile or somewhat neoliberal. But I wonder to what extent we could even say that they're somewhat servile or somewhat neoliberal. I mean, I suppose trying to argue from the other side that some might say, well, they're servile because they cooperated with the United States in the capture or torture of Islamists, you know, in 2001 or 2003, or they've cooperated with the United States in certain ways. Well, sure, they have cooperated with the United States in certain ways, and they don't make history just as they want, and there are certain constraints on any country or any state with what it can do with its economy. But if you look at the way in which the United States regards Syria, they certainly don't regard Syria as being servile in any way, or even being neoliberal in any way. In fact, the United States finds Syria very frustrating because Syria refuses to kowtow or to comply with U.S. dictates. I mean, if Syria wanted to take itself out of the, or to avoid U.S. hostility, one thing it could have done is simply tell Hamas that it couldn't have offices in Damascus. Why did it continue? Why does it continue to support Palestinian liberation movements? Why does it continue to insist on Palestinian self-determination? Why does it support Hezbollah? Why is it that it doesn't liberalize the economy or integrate it as fully as the United States demands? I mean, if the Syrian government was servile and was slightly neoliberal, we wouldn't hear the kinds of complaints from Washington that we hear. And so, you know, when certain people make arguments that there's an uprising against neoliberalism, it just leaves me scratching my head. Because how is it that the United States could be so thoroughly opposed to a government which is neoliberal? I mean, the United States, Washington, is the champion of neoliberalism. It would certainly support neoliberal governments or governments which are moving in a neoliberal direction.
And why would the U.S. government back an uprising against neoliberalism? I mean, that would be absurd. But sorry, I did not mean to imply that the Syrian government was especially servile. There are references to, I mean, the cooperation, the anti-terror cooperation that the Syrian government has engaged in with the United States. And I think we have to look at that in its historical context. That was after 9/11, not very long, almost immediately after 9/11. And the United States was basically on a rampage saying that you're either with us or you're against us. That was the words of the president. You're either with us or you're against us. We're on a war against terror, an infinite war, they called it, against terrorism. And you're with us or you're against us. So you're going to cooperate with us or you're our enemy. And we don't limit ourselves in any way militarily to who we will attack. So they already put Syria on a hit list. And so that there's a country that's trying to hang on. And now it's on a U.S. hit list. The U.S. has made threats against it, and it says you're either with us or you're against it. Syria does have a problem with terrorism. So they were saying, okay, fine. You know, we'll work with you. We'll cooperate on terrorism. They're trying to muddle through this. And, well, I guess that even that didn't really work out so well because the United States, as you point out, looks for opportunities for when these countries become shaky or are perceived as being unstable, and it moves in regardless of whatever relations of cooperation it might have.
Right. I mean, yes. I mean, there's some degree of cooperation among all countries. But all of this seems to come from this desire that some people on the left have to somehow support U.S. intervention in Syria. So let's look at, for some kind of flaw in the Syrian government, which we can then focus on and seize on and say, oh, well, you know, it's not a utopia, therefore we should support the overthrow of the government. It seems almost like saying, well, if that's the case, I mean, the Canadian government is neoliberal as well. So, you know, if there was a Islamist uprising in Canada, would we support the Islamist uprising against the Canadian government because the Canadian government is neoliberal? I mean, these kinds of arguments just seem absurd to me. It seems like certain people are bending over backwards to find some reason to support the intervention of the West in other countries. And they're bending over backwards by essentially saying, well, this country isn't a utopia, so how can I support it?
Yeah, well, that is what's going on. And you sort of cut through all that and laying out the truth, which may be uncomfortable for some people, and they prefer to indulge and engage in fantasies. And we've certainly had a lot of that over the last 5 years, Libya, Syria, revolutions, and so on. And there you are telling the hard truth. We do appreciate you for that. And I forgot to mention at the beginning, of course, that we're all excited to see your article, The Revolutionary Distemper in Syria, because after several months' absence, people, your articles were in high demand. And then we learned you're writing a book. We learned you're writing a book. So that was really good news, actually. And that was very heartening. And you've been focused heavily on Syria, and you have a book coming out in 2017. So, of course, we're going to be hearing more about that. And you've done the work that needs to be done on this. Instead of engaging in fantasies, you have, in fact, investigated the origins of the current conflict and all its relationships with external actors and the whole geopolitics and political economy of the situation, which is sorely needed in the very immature discussions that are occurring right now. So we're very excited about that upcoming book. We will be talking about that. What is the book called?
The book is called Washington's Long War on Syria. And the article about the uprising that wasn't, or the revolutionary distemper that wasn't, is actually drawn heavily from one of the chapters in the book.
Right. So we got a bit of a free preview there, and I like what I see. So for sure, we'll be getting involved with that book. So, Stephen, thanks very much for making your holiday time available for us. It'll be a nice gift for people at the end of the year. So thanks very much again for being on the program with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Brendan.